call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs, Finance Committee to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Junkie.
Here.
Representative Welty. Representative Finstad. Representative Doty.
Here.
Representative Faust.
Here.
Representative Hamilton.
Here.
Representative Hansen.
Here.
Representative Heidgerken.
Here.
Representative Magnus.
Here.
Representative Olin. Representative Otremba. Representative Peterson. Representative Poppy. Representative Schmansky.
All right, in front of you, in your packets, members, you have the minutes from the February 7th meeting. Representative Hansen moves approval of those minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Just a couple notes, members. First of all, reminder, cell phones off. If you answer them, or if they go off, it's a buck. If you answer them, it's $5, Mr. Commissioner. And there's coffee down here for anyone in the committee or the audience that would like a cup. Help yourself. The overhead projector now works. Science fiction, believe it or not. 2 months into the session, darn near, we finally have overheads and PowerPoints will be available, so from this day forward, hopefully folks take advantage of that. Today, members, we're going to try and move through a number of things as quickly as possible and be out of here a little before 11:30. I know there's some people that have meetings at 11:30, including me. So, first of all, we'll bring the Attorney General's office up. In your folders, there's a report on E85. And it's, I think, some pretty good reading, actually, and some good information. But since the AG's office spent a number of time, quite a bit of time compiling it, we want to give them a good bit of time to present it to us and answer any questions that members might have regarding what they did, why they did it, and what it means to us. So. With that, please introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee, and proceed any way you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Ann Kinsella, and I'm a Deputy Attorney General in the Minnesota Attorney General's Office and have worked in and around antitrust law for about 10 years in the Attorney General's Office. And I'm here just to go over our report and answer any questions. The report on E85 pricing was issued last year in May of 2006. And the report looked at some pricing factors and what was going on in the market in a relatively isolated period of time, which is now about 18 months past. But we began the review in the fall of 2005 in response to consumers and wholesalers were raising a number of questions at that time about E85 prices and why they had risen so sharply. But a number of calls. E85 at that time was nearly the price of regular gas. You weren't seeing the typical 30 to 40 cent spread. And in some areas, for brief periods of time, the price of E85 would exceed gas by 10 cents or more. Consumers obviously questioned this and wanted to know what was behind it. And the Attorney General's office takes gas price issues very seriously. It's a pocketbook concern that affects everybody almost immediately, an increased fixed cost, so we always follow up on those complaints. And we found in doing some looking around there's a common belief that the price of E85 should track the price of corn, that if the price of corn is staying the same or going down, that you would think that ethanol in E85 would also have gone down. As I'll get to later, we found that really is not the case. And in the report, there are a couple graphs charting the price of E85 and charting the price of corn and charting the price of regular gas. In response to these concerns, we issued civil investigative demands, which is a request for information that we are authorized to do under statute, to 24 ethanol and E85 producers, marketers, wholesalers, retailers, and fuel terminals, and essentially asked how E85 and ethanol were priced from March through September of 2005. In response, we received quite a bit of information and reviewed approximately 10,000 pages of documents, which included invoices, contracts, and other pricing information. And based on what we reviewed, it appears the price of E85 and ethanol have little correlation with the price of corn. And instead, these prices tend to parallel changes in regular gas prices. And again, as I mentioned in page 2 and page 3 of the report, there are some graphs showing that. And E85 is a supplement or additive for regular gas, or ethanol is an additive for regular gas. And what we learned from talking with people and reviewing documents is that E85 competes with regular gasoline for those who have flexible fuel vehicles. And as a competitor to gasoline, E85 prices are influenced by gas prices, and they tend to consciously parallel those gas prices. What that means is, you know, they will, you know, track somewhat in lockstep those prices. And retailers will change their E85 prices when regular gas prices change. And under the antitrust laws, as long as retailers and others in the distribution chain are making those pricing decisions independently without consulting with, you know, anyone else, then it's not a violation of the state or federal antitrust laws to make independent pricing decisions. Now, obviously, they may have some discussions about what price is being charged by who they're purchasing from, but as long as retailers and at each level people are making independent decisions about what they charge, that wouldn't be a violation under the antitrust laws, because generally speaking, there are two types of violations that come up, which one is an agreement in restraint of trade, which we were looking for that in the documents, and also there are cases, antitrust cases, where the theory is that one actor is so large that they can't engage in certain conduct. That's commonly referred to as a Section 2 or monopoly kind of claim. We were, you know, looking for that as well. As I indicated, the documents we reviewed reflected that ethanol prices are affected, not surprisingly, also by supply and demand. And there were a number of demand factors for ethanol that were having an impact on prices during this period of time we were reviewing. And I'll just mention a few of those. They're detailed more in the report. One thing is, at least three states, including Minnesota, require all or most gasoline to include a minimum percentage of ethanol. As you know, in Minnesota, we have an E10 requirement. There's also was a rapid increase in the use of ethanol at that time as an oxygenate, on the East Coast and in Texas, which was causing ethanol to be pulled out of state to those areas. Those areas were willing to pay a premium. And that was happening also as the use of another oxygenate, MTBE, was being phased out for a variety of reasons. During the past few years, and again around the time of what we were reviewing, about half the states banned or restricted the use of MTBE due to groundwater contamination concerns, including two very large states, New York and California, outlawing MTBE. Minnesota has banned MTBE in 2000, and the new Federal Energy Policy Act of 2005 bans the use of MTBE effective in 2014. So people were looking, you know, those in the supply chain were looking for other additives that they could use if MTBE is going down. And that, this new federal law, the other factors, the state laws, caused the oil companies to announce that they would stop using MTBE and switch entirely to ethanol by the latter half of 2006. Another factor that's discussed in the report in more detail is that many areas require oxygenated fuels and reformulated gas under the Clean Air Act. And all this is to say there was increasing demand for ethanol in E85. Now, and some other information detailed in the report of the Minnesota production at that time, the report found that about 65% of the ethanol was consumed in Minnesota and 35% was being exported, and that Minnesota was also bringing in ethanol from other areas. We looked at the structure of the existing ethanol plants at that time. Most of them are structured as new generation cooperatives, as the committee may well know. Which means they do some processing to the product. They don't just sell the raw product. There's some processing, some value added that the co-op adds. And there's an antitrust exemption for that activity as long as all the members are, they must produce and not just process, and the co-op can't deal with non-member products more than member products. Looked at the different cost components to ethanol, the capital costs at that time, the equipment costs and building a plant averaged about $1.57 per gallon, and the variable costs were about 96 cents per gallon, including the cost of corn and operating costs and other things. The ethanol E85 cost did not appear to be based solely or primarily even on production costs. Instead, the contracts and otherwise showed that ethanol prices, as I mentioned earlier, are typically based on gas prices or competitors' ethanol prices. And those prices are all widely published in the Oil Price Information Survey, commonly referred to as OPIS, and Axis Petroleum, another reporting service. So the prices during that time varied widely based from geographic area and even from terminal to terminal for ethanol. Much like gas, the report concluded that generally the closer you are to the supplier the purchase is made, the lower the price will be to the end user, which makes sense as the product moves along the distribution chain. There's additional fees for storage and delivery added. The report also found that retailers who were part of a vertically integrated chain were able to buy E85 at lower prices from their parent corporation than other retailers who were having to buy from independent sources. Also during the time of the investigation, and this relates to the demand factors I went to earlier, the ethanol market was perceived as tight or undersupplied, so there was a premium for prompt deliveries. There was an incentive to sell the E85 you had at that time and not to store it. So it encouraged the liquidation of stored stock. And so for the time period we reviewed, a number of factors were at work affecting E85 and making some of the interesting situations where you even had E85 selling for more than gas for short periods of time. And again, the information we reviewed showed that, you know, E85 prices and ethanol prices don't have a relationship to the price of corn, even though there is a common belief that they should. We did not, based on the evidence we received, find any agreements or any unlawful monopoly. And just something to mention as an aside, the courts have consistently held that evidence of high prices or evidence of quickly changing prices or uniform prices. We will get a lot of calls from time to time. You know, all the gas prices change at the same time. Surely there must be a price-fixing agreement, and we have done the numerous investigations and never, not to this point, concluded that there is, have never found an agreement. And in a market like gasoline where the prices are posted and it's a commodity and price is a very important selling point, economic theory would suggest that you would tend to see uniform prices, and pricing surveys of your competitors' prices in the gas market seem to be, you know, a common practice, and prices do change so rapidly it almost seems like they change at once. But to this date, we haven't found evidence of an antitrust violation in the gas market, and we didn't find any evidence of a conspiracy in the E85 study that was released last year. I'm happy to take any questions.
All right. Thank you for that. Again, the report, members, you've been looking at it, is in front of you. It's probably a nice piece of information to put in your save folder. It lists all the ethanol plants. It does talk about some of the supply chain issues that we visited on the other day. And I guess I have one question. You mentioned, and I just want to corroborate, you were here last week when we talked about pricing. And typically, I think what this committee is discovering is that it seems everyone basically along the chain is making a fair profit from ethanol. You know, obviously the plant, the farmer, the plants. When it gets to what they call the rack, we learned about last week, before it goes down through the rack, there's probably a profit to those folks that are blending it at those rack places. They build that in and come down. But where we're probably finding some discrepancies is at the retail level. Again, for whatever reason, sometimes they're selling even at a loss. Two questions. Is it true that ethanol E85 blend does not have to, isn't it law in Minnesota that gasoline cannot be sold under the cost to get it to your station? And is E85 in that boat?
It is true there's a general sales below cost prohibition for gasoline. I would have to check and get back to you, Mr. Chairman, on, I believe 85 would fall in that definition, but I haven't looked at that specifically. But the Department of Commerce does enforce a statute that says that gasoline cannot be sold below cost, and there's a very detailed definition of cost in the statute that
you could check
the Commerce
that
Department can look to.
Okay. Let us know if E85 falls into that, because I've heard it does not.
Okay.
And then you also indicated that typically, a lot of times, if you're associated with a chain, rather than buying from an independent, that many times perhaps that chain is negotiating lower prices, and that might contribute. In other words, I'll just use an example. If you're part of the Holiday Station folks, they're marketing their own product at the rack or their own blends, and they have probably independently locked in a price for ethanol, as opposed to an independent station who drives in and says, I need a load of E85. And they're probably getting a price of the day rather than a negotiated price. Is that what you're finding?
There are probably, Mr. Chairman, I think there were a number of factors at work depending on the situation, but just sort of as a general rule, found that the retailers who were part of a vertically integrated chain were able to purchase supply at lower prices, and it could be because their supplier had locked in purchased before prices went up, or there may be fewer transaction costs in that chain.
Did you look at also, one more question, and I have some others I want to ask. Did you also look at the number of people that market ethanol in the state? It appears that only maybe one or two or a handful of people actually market for all the plants in the state. They go through a broker, if you will, who goes to the East Coast or West Coast or within the state. Is that problematic to have not enough people where it kind of comes into one or two entities and then it's marketed out? Do you find or did you look at what they do to price the product, or are they having any influence?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We did review information from marketers, and that's my understanding. It is a smaller number of marketers. And in and of itself, that there's not a problem with that unless they're, working, as I said, working together, some sort of unlawful agreement among those marketers. But the fewer players you have in the market, the easier it is to track what your competitors are doing.
Representative Heiger.
Mr. Chair, you did a very good job. Thank you.
Oh, answered your question, too, huh? All right. Any other questions, members, for the Attorney General's Office? All right, very good. Thank you. We appreciate
the
report. We'll stay on the theme of ethanol, and we'll invite our commissioner down, and Steve Ernest, I believe, are here, or whoever you've got with you. Yep. Members, you've got your books in front of you. We're going to, over the next many days now, probably the balance of this month and into next month, certainly, we'll start doing some budget overviews. Basically, the books you have will have the budgets in them based on the governor's request. And so we're really presenting the governor's bill here and the commissioners here on behalf of the governor, obviously, and representing him. So as we go through these things, we'll also probably mix in some bills periodically. Example, and just a notice, Representative Finstead and folks, we'll probably hear the RFA bill next Tuesday, and then we'll do an overview also on the RFA program. That same day, we'll try and match them up. But I know a lot of you have received calls from banks that are anxious to get that RFA money flowing. So we're going to move that bill out. I believe the Senate's going to move it on Thursday, and we're going to move it out on Tuesday and hopefully get that going earlier so we don't have to wait till June 1st or July 1st to have that money available. But just a heads up on that for next week. And we'll be hearing more and more bills as we get into the next few weeks here also, along with our budget overviews. So, Mr. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. And introduce yourself and proceed. We're looking at two things today, and I believe you're aware of that. Your ethanol producer payment program and what you see are our needs for that in the future here, near future, and then the next gen proposal, which is a new proposal, I believe, coming out of the department this year. So welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Gene Hugeson, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chairman, if I might, I just as a follow-up to the Attorney General's Office report, I was in Washington over the weekend. The Ag Departments from the 50 states had their midwinter meeting, and obviously renewable fuels is an important part of that, but there was some testimony by an organization called the Renewable Fuels Association, the RFA, on the national level, which is a consortium of the various groups that are involved with renewable fuels. But a presentation by them, I think, kind of puts in perspective and confirms what the Attorney General's office was talking about, that in 2006, nationally, we had a capacity of producing 5.3 billion gallons during the year. But at that same time, there was a demand for about 6 billion gallons. So almost a billion gallon deficit in terms of the amount that was needed or wanted or desired compared to what was actually available. Now, the interesting thing is that at the same time we're looking at that scenario, we've actually got 77 plants nationwide that are under construction. And when they are up and running, that's going to add another 6.1 billion gallons a year to the production in the United States. And then there are dozens of other plants that are in various stages of discussion and so forth. The point I raise here is that I think it's something that we're going to want to be cognizant of, is that while we're certainly seeing a situation where there's a high demand for ethanol and the price reflects that, we could turn that around very quickly and see a different scenario in the near future. And so it's something that I think we're going to want to be aware of. Minnesota has done a very good job of creating demand at the same time we've created the supply, unlike most other states. And that's the one thing that I think we need to be cognizant of and be talking about down the road here as well.
Mr. Commissioner, as you looked at those production numbers, did they also project demand numbers? You say we're short now, but when 6 more million gallons come on, how does that track with the demand?
The dilemma is that the projections that I have seen show that the demand is actually going to be relatively flat. It will increase slightly, but not a whole lot. As the Attorney General's office mentioned, we've gone through some factors here lately with a couple states, big states, that have switched from MTBE over to ethanol, and certainly most of the fuel companies are substituting ethanol already. But unless we start to see some changes in either some incentives or some kind of a mechanism for doing some of the things that Minnesota has done. For instance, Louisiana just introduced or has passed an ethanol requirement, but it's at 2%. So there's some things that are going to be coming online that will maybe make some difference in some of the states, but none to the extent that Minnesota has done or is anticipating doing, even with our E20 program that's up and online.
Representative Hagerton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, Commissioner Hugeson, you did touch upon what some of the other states are doing. I know Michigan, among others, are looking at more incentives and more requirements. But at the same time, I think that the future holds very, very promising for ethanol. Say, for example, at a national level, if we would pull out of Iraq tomorrow, what do you think gas prices would be?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hydrickson, I'm not an economist.
Anybody with any knowledge, we saw what the hurricanes had done, and if we would pull out, and there's a lot of pressure to do that, and if we pull out, I wouldn't be surprised within 24 hours to see gas at $10 a gallon.
Well, and that could very well be, Mr. Chairman, members. The issue, though, is, I mean, there's a lot of things. We're literally a bomb away from a worldwide catastrophe from shutting down some supply some places. And certainly that's a lot of the impetus, I think, where the United States has moved, and certainly where Governor Plenty has gone, as it relates to we're not going to be totally energy independent or oil independent, but we be less dependent is I think, the goal that we're looking at here. Mr. Chairman, members, if I could, I'd like to just kind of quickly run through some of the issues that we're putting together here as it relates to the governor's promotion of next generation energy. And if you remember from his budget proposal, there's actually $40 million that are proposed or suggested for inclusion in this budget bill that is before the legislature this year.
Mr. Commissioner or Mr. Ernst, if you have page numbers in your budget or that you're directing us to while you're talking, it'd be helpful to.
I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the overall points, and then I'll tie in specifically to the one that we're looking at that's here.
Very good.
The one that we will talk about or that I will expand on more will be the $10 million that's going into biomass technology to encourage us to begin the process of moving us to the next generation of biofuels. But there's also, in the Department of Commerce, grants for $5 million that will go for solar rebates, plug-in vehicles, methane digester grants that would be available. Certainly there's another $12 million that's being proposed for developing more E85 fueling stations. We currently have about 300. That the governor's proposal is to raise that by 1,500 up to 1,800 gallons or stations. I was at another meeting not too long ago where I heard that California had doubled their E85 stations from 1 to 2. But we are a little bit ahead of that and intend to be much farther ahead of that when this is all done. There's also $10 million for some competitive energy research grants through the Department of Commerce as well to be available for the University of Minsk, RE, and any of the other entities that are looking at some research. And then there was also a small $3 million proposal for PCA's green fleets and the fuels program that they're looking at there. But what I'd like to zero in, first of all, would be that $10 million grant proposal here for the Department of Agriculture, and I'll ask Mr. Ernst to highlight in your book where that is, and then I'll walk through it a little bit.
Mr. Ernst, where are we at?
Mr. Chairman, Steve Ernest, Financial Management Director at the Department of Agriculture. Page 49 is the change item. And 2008 and 2009, $5 million are the points we're talking about now, and it's described the bottom third of that page.
Mr. Chairman, members, if I could highlight just a little bit what we're looking at doing here. I think all of us are aware that we do need to be looking beyond just the grains as the supply for the ethanol feedstock. And so with that in mind, certainly from the governor's perspective, we're looking at cellulosic opportunities. The reality is, though, it's going to take us a while to get the cellulosic production up and running. Part of that, again, goes back to this idea of how do you create supply, how do you create a process in place here so that you are ratcheting all of this up at the same time. Part of our thought is that we need to and can actually begin almost immediately helping some of the existing ethanol plants or other industries start to use a cellulosic material for the fuel in place of natural gas. There are a few of the plants that are already moving in some of that direction, but we could use either corn stover, you can use wheat straw, you can use wood waste product. And what the idea behind these grants would be is that would be an opportunity for existing plants to begin switching over their power source to a cellulosic material. Now, part of the benefit of that is that we are creating then a market for a product so that we start to build up an infrastructure that ultimately, when we get to the point where we want to be using cellulosic material for actual ethanol production, we're moving in that direction. We're creating opportunities earlier for farmers to begin producing this. We're creating an infrastructure for equipment that would be needed to harvest, to transport this product as well. And when we look at what we've got going for us here in Minnesota, we're in an excellent position to be doing this sort of a shift and changeover. We are already seeing the plant at Little Falls, for instance, using some of the wood product that can come off of the forest areas of northern Minnesota. We know that there are areas in northwestern Minnesota that are looking at ethanol production, certainly some of the opportunities they could have to use some of the wheat straw in that area. Many of you are perhaps aware of one of the growing plants that's actually going to be switching, converting over to corn stalk usage just across the border into Iowa a little ways. So those kinds of things are coming online, but this would enable Minnesota to, I think, move in the direction of getting us up and running in that area earlier than we'll even be able to do when we get to the cellulosic use manufacturing or production of ethanol itself. Now, what we would propose under this would be a series of grants that would be made available. and a structure would be put in place that would determine how those grants would be given out, and it would include some agency involvement, but also inviting the House and the Senate to appoint not necessarily a member, but somebody that would be knowledgeable in these areas from each of those bodies, or whomever they would choose to do that direction, to move in that direction. But if you notice on the bottom of page 49, it lays out the criteria that we would envision would be in place for someone to qualify for those particular types of grants. But the idea again here is to be somewhat general so that we do allow for various kinds of technologies to be used. Because one of the things I think all of us, if we paid any attention to this whole process, is the cellulosic ethanol talk and hype really that's going on out there is not specific at this point. There's a lot of possibilities out there. And I would caution all of us, the legislature, the administration as well, to be able to make sure we structure things in a way that allow that flexibility so that we don't lock ourselves into something too rigid to keep us from being able to go with some of that that down the road.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tookie, and to the Commissioner. I've brought up in front of the committee a couple times, and as you're aware, the Benson plant has a gasification project. And there, as the feedstocks you listed, they're trying to determine, you know, which one should they use or how should it go. But it seems like that the Pollution Control Agency can't seem to or is cautious about granting a real air quality permit. And it doesn't seem to allow the flexibility in the permitting process on air quality to recognize that they're testing many, many different feedstocks. So is there any grant we could give to the department, the PCA, to allocate resources so that they, maybe they're not hindering the development, but, I'm on the phone with this, with ethanol plant in Benson, every 3, 4, 6 days, about this air quality permit, and it was promised at the end of December, and it's still kind of in a draft, revised, not sure form. So it's an agency that seems to be holding up this hype development. I'm wondering if there's any commissioner-to-commissioner type talk between the governor's office, you, and the PCA commissioner that could, open up the, possibilities for using more of these feedstocks and have somebody at the Pollution Control Agency who, can keep up to what the private sector is demanding, at least in Benson.
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, certainly I'm not in a position to speak for PCA, nor should I.
I know.
But let me give you my perspective. I think one of the challenges that I see PCA having is that certainly they are scrutinized very heavily from people on all sides of the issue. And so they move very cautiously in this area based on past experiences here in Minnesota in the sense that people are very aware of what the law says and making sure that from their perspective PCA abides by those rulings. So I think one of the issues that comes up, and you touched on it, is that they have had a staffing issue as it relates to doing some of this. And one of the proposals in the governor's budget concerning not only PCA, but I think it's also a couple of the other agencies, would allow them to add some staff to assist in this area, because it is recognized that there are delays that are taking place that are causing some challenges out there, certainly with existing permitting that's going on, but it'll also accelerate as we move into some of these areas. So I think the point that you raised has been recognized and is going to attempt to be addressed by this manner. Having said that, we are in communication from the Department of Ag, recognizing that we bring our perspective again to the whole discussion, and we'll continue to do so.
Thank you. No problem.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is trying to figure out how big a drop in the bucket this $5 million is providing. And so the plant in Little Falls, I believe, has switched over from natural gas to using wood byproducts. Do you have any idea how much it costs them to do that conversion? And a ballpark would be close enough.
Commissioner Hughes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Faust, ballpark somewhere is between $1 and $20 million. How's that for ballpark?
That's a pretty big ballpark.
Seriously, I have heard, but I don't remember. And I hesitate to give a figure without getting more specific, but I certainly can probably get that for you relatively near future here, perhaps there might even be somebody in the audience that would know more details. I know we've got some people at the department, but they're not the ones that are here today that are aware of that.
Representative Heigerken?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And playing devil's advocate, I'm going to continue along with Representative Peterson's thoughts. Why is it, I mean, when I look at that, it's a very small peanut, as I agree with Representative Faust. When you look at some of these plants are probably burning $30 million worth of natural gas a year to operate, wouldn't it be more feasible for your department to go into research on DDGs and try to get some of these plants to be all wet rather than, if you can cut the cost on dry, if you don't have to dry, if you can sell the product wet, you can cut the cost in half, all these ethanol plants. We need to get the poultry industry, the pork industry, everybody else using this product with livestock. And there has been very, very little research done by the University of Minnesota. I realize that's not your problem, but that is of an issue. And I think that's something that the end product is not being, you know, pushed as much as it, because it could save a ton of money.
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, Representative Heidrichen, I don't know that a whole lot of research is actually needed, because I think it's already been shown that some of this is in place, and, you know, there's some economic studies that will show how much you save. I know, for instance, there is an ethanol plant, I believe it's in Nebraska, that is located right next to a feedlot. And what they do is they, of course, just literally auger the DDGs from the ethanol plant over to the cattle feeding operation, and then likewise capture the methane gas and use that to fire and power the ethanol plant. So it's kind of a, you know, closed loop system. So there are some things already that are happening in that area that would illustrate that you know, that sort of thing could happen. I could see another, you know, there's really all kinds of opportunities where you could do some partnering kinds of things, greenhouses next to a ethanol plant, to where you have the hot water that is coming off could be used to help heat that facility for growing hydroponic tomatoes or roses or whatever else might be in need at a given time. So there's certainly the opportunities out there, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that as we move ahead. Now, is this a drop in the bucket? Perhaps overall it is, but what we're looking at here are just the means of the state, not necessarily funding, excuse me, funding the whole thing, but to become somewhat of the incentive to help move it in that area. I mean, literally, financing is not always the total problem in doing this, because the package can be laid out that would show that indeed it does make sense for an ethanol plant to invest money in making that change. And the other thing I think that, you know, we need to be addressed quite honestly is that the ethanol plants, at least lately here, have not necessarily been cash strapped. They have they've had some money with which to do this, and so this isn't necessarily the idea that it can't be done, but this is the state's way of helping to incentivize in maybe a small way, but to move in that direction.
Hey.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and I'll touch on the other part of the proposal, because then I think what we need to then give you a chance to either ask me questions overall or else have Mr. Ernest go into more detail. But on that same page, page 49 of your sheet, if you'll notice in fiscal years 10 and 11, it shows $9 million each year of those years. What the governor is proposing under his budget would be that these would be the first 2 years of a 10-year program of $9 million each year to be made available for some mechanism to help incentivize the actual production of cellulosic ethanol. And how we do that, I think, is yet to be determined. And so the proposal under the governor's legislation, when you actually see it, would be this, that rather than specify under legislation this year, how it would actually look, is that we would create a board that would be made up of some representatives from the administration and the legislature to look at the various options, again, to allow the flexibility, and then come back in the 08 legislative session and enact that into place. The other issue here that I think you need to be very careful about considering here is what's going to be done in the 07 Farm Bill. Every indication, and I, it was reiterated this weekend when I was out there, and I think some of you have heard this from various sources as well, is that there will be a significant part in the 07 Farm Bill coming out of Washington that will be devoted to renewable energy, and including the promotion of cellulosic ethanol. And so our idea here is that in as much as we're not at the point of building cellulosic ethanol plants yet, and knowing that there will be some provisions in the Federal Farm Bill, we want to make sure that what we do in Minnesota is able to leverage what the Federal Farm Bill is going to have in there and be able to then maximize that and actually perhaps put something in place that would be in different regions of the state using some different technology and as a means of becoming sort of the demonstrators of where those what those ethanol plants might look like. When we move to cellulosic ethanol production, there are some hurdles yet. From every indication that we've picked up, to build a cellulosic ethanol plant costs about four times the amount of a conventional ethanol plant from corn. And the operating costs are probably 50% above and beyond where the existing plants are right now, too. So there are some things that are going to be unique to these plants that are going to inhibit the rapid move into that direction. Some of the technology is not quite there. Now, with some of these initial plants that are being built, including the one in northwest Iowa, they're talking $200 to $300 million for a plant like that. And when you look at what we're building our existing ethanol plants for, it's considerably less. Yet we all recognize that to move ahead down the road, we are going to have to move in that direction based on the feedstock supply for grain, recognizing that if there's not enough corn or soybeans in the United States to make a serious dent on the imported oil situation. So it only makes sense to be moving in this other direction. And so the proposal that comes from the administration will be that we want to be position ourselves in a good way to be able to access what the Federal Farm Bill will have and to be able to incentivize some of our people to move in that direction as well. And so that's why the proposal then will have that more or less a delay till the 2008 to actually see the specifics to give us a chance because everything we're hearing is that there's still debate in terms of what kind of technology is going to be used or what we're going to be focusing on in terms of how this is done. And we want to make sure that, again, we create something that has the latitude to allow these various technologies to be used and incentivized, as it were, by the state.
Commissioner, I will concur with you that we've had those discussions, too. We were in Washington a few weeks ago and met with Congressman Peterson's staff, Senator Vickman and I, and Representative Otremba met personally with his ag staff, and we continue to coordinate with them very closely, too, along with your staff, I'm sure. But the dilemma we face, as you pointed out, is at the earliest, probably, the Farm Bill will be out in September. If we're still on continuing resolutions from last year, so there's no guarantee of that either. We hope they're done by September. And I agree with you that we have to be a little fluid, if you will, on our exact dollars so that we can have something ready to go if it utilizes federal dollars in a way that's beneficial to Minnesota or the upper Midwest states here. And I suspect with Congressman Peterson in the position he is, he will be looking at trying to do exactly that with us here. So I think that's a key ingredient, members, as we try and put these bills together, is to think about how we can access federal dollars also along with ours and have a bigger bang from both ends. So, and frankly, the way they write their bill may be, they may write contingencies based on matching state dollars. We may write a bill contingent on matching federal dollars, and voila, perhaps that works out to a benefit for us. So we have to be very careful what we do and make sure that we're planning for any outcome that may come out of Washington, too.
Mr. Chairman, members, I mean, you're exactly right, and I think we are in agreement on that. And looking at the timetable, and we had that discussion with certainly some congressional staff while we were in Washington as well. The goal is certainly the end of September, October in that area. It could go, of course, till the end of the calendar year also. But I think even by that time, though, the energy portion should be fairly solid, because that's an area that both sides of the aisle, with the administration, there generally is pretty good agreement. We maybe won't see that final piece, and probably the sticker is going to be the dollars. Where will those dollars actually come from in the bill in the end?
And I think they do have an energy subcommittee, so
yes.
You're right. Their work should be completed hopefully well before the final bill is out.
So, Mr. Chairman, the last thing I would conclude with is that I think, one of the other things is that this $9 million a year, we want to be creative in terms of how that is actually allocated to these facilities. Do we do it based on gallons per year produced? Do we do it on BTUs per gallon necessary for fueling it in the first place? I think there's a number of ways that this could be looked at and done in a way that becomes a positive incentive, recognizing that there's a lot of people out there watching this whole changeover to cellulosic production from the lending institutions as well, and so they're going to be watching because of the large amount. Looking for some assurances coming from the federal and state government, at least for initial. And that's the role we played in Minnesota with our original ethanol program as well. It was done as much to placate the lending institutions' nervousness about a technology that they weren't sure of, that since has shown that it does work, and now most states have moved ahead with producing ethanol without the kind of program that we had in Minnesota to start with.
Mr. Commissioner, on page 49, you kind of lay out the 5 plus 5 for 08 and 09, and for members on page 50, they lay out the $9 million envision per year in two major parts there, the financing investment-based menu of incentives, and you see three under there. That's $6 million a year, and then $3 million a year for direct production payments. To that point, are you envisioning then the financing part of that being run through the RFA? Make that a program or a part of the RFA, which I think it probably should be, but it doesn't say that specifically here, and I guess I'd ask you that for the record here.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, that's I would say that is flexible, but I would envision that's the way it would be handled as well, right, because it would be this part would be handled by the Department of Agriculture, and it would be logical that we would be, using it through that. Obviously, with Mr. Ernest involved with it as well as he is with every dollar that goes out of the department.
My second question is, I guess I'm a little concerned or question. The direct production payments, it's $30 million over 10 years, again, with up to $1 million per year per plant. So essentially what you're talking about is three facilities if they're using the maximum of $1 million per year. Are you talking about three retrofit current plants that would qualify, the CVEC that Representative Peterson was talking about, or the Little Falls that we heard over here? Going to them, or are you talking about new facilities that would be springing up for cellulosic or other types of alternative ethanol production?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would envision that would be part of the discussion that this board would have. I would personally like to see a combination that you would in essence use something that would be done on an existing facility. You might be looking at different geographic locations in the state using different technologies in a way that would really serve a valuable use of demonstrating what does work, what is going to work best here down the road. And I would also caution members, folks, too, that while we're talking $9 million per year and divided up 3 and 6. You know, that isn't to say that there couldn't be. Maybe when this board comes back in the beginning of the session of 08, they might look at something a little differently than what we've got here, because there's, as I say, there's still some things to be learned in terms of what's the best way to achieve what we hope to achieve.
And Mr. Commissioner, another question I would have is, and a question, frankly, that our committee is going to wrestle with, I suspect, a little bit, is whether we want to go a producer payment route at this time or not. Are we that far along where we can predict and lock ourselves in like we did with ethanol, corn ethanol, to 10-year payments? That'd be the first question we're going to have to talk about. But then secondly, and again, it doesn't say specifically, and obviously we'll look at the exact language, but are you projecting that these should be counter-cyclical payments where, you know, again, if the plant is making a certain profit, those payments come back into the pot and not out? I think that's one of the things that folks wish we maybe would have looked at closer with the current plants, although I think what we did was fine and we should live up to it. But into the future, have we learned, or are we doing anything different in that realm?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would hope we would seriously consider looking at a counter-cyclical type of approach. I would also hope that we would look seriously at a mechanism in there that if the state is going to be investing these monies into what we would refer to as majority farmer-owned kind of facilities, that there would be some provision in there that would say that if, in fact, that facility is sold within a reasonable period of time afterwards, that the state would have opportunities to recoup that investment.
And Mr. Commissioner, are you developing language, or is that in the bill? I know the bill hasn't been introduced yet. It's coming, but have you got that language yet, or is that still a work in progress? Both the community ownership piece and the what to do upon sale piece.
Mr. Chairman, members, that's still a work in progress.
Okay, we'll be working with you on that. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in our discussion here, and the Commissioner alluded to it earlier, we don't really know which is the correct pathway to go down, or which will the path that will lead us in the best interest of the state. And so far we've spent a lot of time discussing about the what I envision as industrial-sized cellulosic-based ethanol or energy-producing biofuel, I should say, because we don't know, again, even which fuel is going to be out there to be used. So I would encourage us to keep an open mind on this. We don't know the products. We don't know the technology. We don't know if it, in fact, is in the best interest of the state that we do look at the industrial-sized plants. It may be, in the discussions that I've had over the last several months working on energy things and with folks at the U and in other areas, that we may be looking at neighborhood-owned plants. When you're talking about moving cellulosic-based materials around, you've got significant challenges on your hand that differ tremendously from whether you're going to use barley or feed wheat or corn as your source. So we don't know just what's going to happen, and we don't know whether these will be, if in fact we do go to some industrial plants, whether they'll be standalone plants or add-ons to current existing plants. Those are all unknowns to this point. So I think the best thing we can do is stay certainly
neutral
on the technology parts of it, and neutral certainly on the products part of it for now, until the path becomes a little clearer for us.
And certainly that's a good comment and heeded. And members, we probably will hear from some of those smaller folks before we put our bill together too, and we may have an opportunity to give some incentives out even this year, not waiting for a year or two to put this committee together and maybe get some of those smaller projects started or taken a look at them, because I concur there's going to be a lot of community-sized plants out there. I believe you're absolutely right, and I believe that's more of a European model, which is proved, I think, over time to be a benefit to a lot of their communities. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, and Mr. Chair and the Commissioner, and what Representative Magnus was talking about, I'm looking at the U.S. News and World Report, which I bought over the weekend in Madison the last copy of. It's just, you know, the overselling of ethanol. And there's a couple points in here. 60% of the ethanol production today is in the hands of small companies, is what this article says. Then it goes into people I think you're probably familiar with, Verison and Steve Kirby out of Blue Stem, out of former lieutenant governor out of South Dakota. And then it gets into a large name and investor, Bill Gates, the Carlyle Group, where former President Bush 41 was a director. And then it says the 10 largest ethanol producers and their trade groups have handed out about $5 million in campaign contributions since 2000, and that the Renewable Fuels Association has increased its lobbying spending 60% in the past 7 years, and that former Senators Bob Dole and Tom Daschle tout the ethanol in there. They're working with this group called 21st Century Agriculture Policy Project. Given what Representative Magnus said, are these the people who are going to decide what the technology route we're going to go down is, potentially, based on the fundraising levels?
Commissioner, a loaded question for you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson and members, I can't give you a definitive answer on that, but let me go back to kind of the point that Representative Magnus raised. Cellulosic ethanol plants, for every indication, are going to have to be geographically determined, more so than grain ethanol plants, because the magnitude of the amount of product that's going to have to be delivered to those facilities to generate the ethanol is tremendous. Imagine the amount of bales of corn stalks, for instance, that it would take to keep that going, and the logistics of doing it in a way that it would take a huge parking lot for all those to be developed at the end of the crop year, and so it's probably a situation where they're, you know, it's going to require on-farm storage and delivering on a regular basis kind of thing. The equipment that it's going to take is going to require that there be quite a bit of equipment in a small area, as opposed to a few pieces that's going to be able to cover 100 square miles, kind of thing. So I think some of the logistics of all of this is going to dictate where these facilities are located, the size of these facilities, the fuel product that that's going to be used here, the feedstock product that's going to be used, more so than somebody sitting in Washington or Wall Street or elsewhere. Now, the capital for, you know, financing this is another issue. And that's certainly something that interests all of us. Going back to my opening comments in terms of, you know, where the ethanol industry is right now and where it's going to be maybe over even the next 12 months, Wall Street has taken a big interest in this based on the rate of return that these farmer-owned co-ops have seen at the local ethanol plants. But ethanol production, like politics, timing is everything. And my gut feeling is that the rate of return over the next 2 years isn't going to be the same as it's been over the past 2 years. And so maybe there's some of that hype from Wall Street won't be there down the road either. But with that in mind, you know, we've got to make sure that we create policies that, going back to perhaps the counter-cyclical model, that allows for that to you know, to happen, because too often we've seen in the past, and you know, going back to Jimmy Carter and the sweaters and energy conservation, it was exciting for, or a big thing to do, for a few years, and then U.S. lost sight of it, and in the end we ended up with a bunch of big fuel guzzlers driving up and down the roads in the meantime. So somewhere along the line we have to develop some policy that has some teeth to it and some stay power to see where this all goes. And you know, from an agriculture standpoint, we are in a good position to be part of that, but we have to recognize that it's beyond just agriculture at this point as well.
And Representative Peterson and members, I'm getting copies of that article. Someone actually gave me that article before the committee started, so we're getting you copies so you can have in your folders or bring back to your office. And there's an additional article I was handed also. And again, Commissioner, I do concur with you and Peterson and Magnus, and it's good that we're kind of starting to coalesce, I think, because I do think it's important. I think there's a number of things we need to consider as these bills. And again, just to reiterate, Representative Peterson's bill that we'll see on the floor of the House here, I suspect shortly, concerns electricity. And there's going to be other bills coming. When we talked about we want to bring the bills down here and make sure that, our interests are being reflected, there are other bills that are going to be assembled, members, that will deal with biofuels and biomass and other things that are going to have a direct impact on our bill and our committee's eyes. And so we're going to bring those down and look at them as they progress and certainly incorporate any of your ideas or bills that you have. But again, I think, at least from where I sit at this point in time, and again, we'll have many committee discussions on it, there's a number of factors we need to consider, and community ownership is one, and I'm glad to see that the department is talking about that. I think that's extremely important. I think research dollars, you know, giving money out to research and standing out of the way, not dictating, but making sure we're facilitating some research is going to be extremely important for technologies in our state. How do you handle, how do you store, how do you ship, how do you plant, how do you fertilize, how do you harvest? We don't know the answers to this, and again, we think we can hook into the federal farm bill on that. And then the capital requirements. Extremely important. Again, I was on a panel a few weeks ago or a month ago now, a CERTS panel up in St. Cloud. One of the number one things we heard, and this was mainly small community-based people that are CERTS people in that room over and over, is they don't have access to capital. And when you look at a proposal here that talks about establishing unsecured, low-interest loans, where the state would assume up to a 50% potential default, that's pretty attractive. And if we can put those packages together, then along with our bankers, who will participate on a local level through the RFA, I think we're going to do a world of good in facilitating some of these small startups that can also prove that technology out there. So I think we can do some pretty decent stuff this year in this committee to get us on that road. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I had a question on something a little different, that let's say in the next few years that Cuba becomes free and that sugarcane ethanol becomes massively produced on our doorstep, or sugarcane just in general, and available for export. What, you know, you're going to Washington, you're meeting with other commissioners of agriculture. We have a sugar beet industry here. What happens with that possibility of low-cost sugarcane ethanol right at our doorstep? What does that do? You know, is there an ability to move beets into ethanol more effectively? Just overall, I'd like your perspective on some of that possibility.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, certainly Cuba would have that potential, but I would also suggest that actually Mexico has a larger potential, just because of the landmass that they have there and the availability to do something. And in fact, they do have a fairly active and thriving industry there. Currently, I think you're aware there's a tariff on the importation of sugar that is good through 2009. What happens to it beyond that, of course, remains to be seen. The other thing, and having had the opportunity to be in Cuba a few years ago with the previous governor, one of the things that was interesting is that their sugarcane industry has so deteriorated that most of their sugarcane growing areas have been converted over to growing fruits and vegetables. So if they were, in fact, to try to reestablish that, it would have to more or less start all over. Now, in terms of producing ethanol, sugarcane is certainly the most efficient and effective way to do it with the agricultural crops out there right now. Corn comes in next, and sugar beets are a little ways down the road. But there are technologies being explored and researched to see if, in fact, that couldn't be done. France is already doing it, but France has a little different way of doing things as it relates to agriculture, so there's probably a healthy subsidy that's going on. Interesting thing to note, though, is Brazil. And Brazil does have a very active sugar cane industry and is, in fact, making a lot of ethanol out of sugar cane. They have a mandate in Brazil that requires 25-26% use of ethanol in mixed in all of their fuel. But it has the flexibility of actually going down to 20% based on the price ratio between petroleum and sugar cane. And what's happened is that even in Brazil, with all their sugar cane, they can't keep up with the demand there. So while certainly there's that potential of a sugar cane being at our doorstep, I think it's overall, unless there's a huge difference in pricing between something going on in Brazil, for instance, and what's going on in the United States or Mexico, that there's actually room for all of this to exist and be done in such a way that is not going to threaten our fledging, if it were, the ethanol industry nationwide. Here in Minnesota, we're much more established than we are nationwide. But what's interesting is that in Brazil, even with their 25-26% mandate, they had to drop that down to 20% this last fall because they ran out of sugar cane. They couldn't. It was too high priced to compete even with oil. Oil being at the price it was. Now Brazil has the advantage as you know, the government owns the oil company or the big oil company, and they're also determining the sugar cane policy. But it is something that's certainly worth watching, and it's of course interesting to note that many of those same cars that they're driving in Brazil with 25% ethanol are not, they're modified a bit from what we have here, but not a whole lot different.
And Commissioner, did your group have you been looking at and talking about to this point an imported ethanol or made of sugar or anything else, essentially that 51-cent blender credit from the federal government in place, I believe, till 2010. I don't know that they're necessarily going to address it this year. I think it's more of an energy bill discussion rather than an ag bill, but perhaps they will. And that's essentially a roundabout way of putting a tariff on imported ethanol. Have you talked about what happens if that goes away, or on the other side, is there lobbying efforts already begun to continue that?
Mr. Chairman, members, yesterday when before I left Washington, I was talking to former Congressman Charlie Stenholm, and you know he's from Texas, a Democrat, and NASDA, the organization of the State Department of Agriculture, has retained him for some consulting purposes as we've been working on some farm bill. He said really the whole idea of a counter-cyclical approach in Congress is gaining a lot of favor as well. So I don't necessarily look to see that withdrawn before 2010, I do think it's very possible that you're going to see a policy in place beyond that could have a counter-cyclical approach in that as well. And that, you know, frankly, that makes sense.
Representative Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being with us today. My comments are not intended to rain on anybody's parade, but I think they're going to piggyback onto Representative Magnus's comments. Commissioner, we're talking about essentially $28 million in the next 4 years for this next-gen proposal. And in Peterson, Magnus, Junkie's comments about, you know, being neutral, being open to the research, what are we talking as far as research dollars? I mean, are we going side by side with research and producer payments at the same time into an unknown world? I shouldn't say unknown. I think we know a lot about it, but do you feel comfortable that the research is there? I'm sure you do because you're presenting this, but can you give me a little more confidence that the research is there, that the $28 million investment over the next 4 years is warranted and it will be, you know, something to keep us as a leader in renewable energy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Binstead, the amount here for research, is that going to get us to where we need to be 2 years, 4 years from now? No. I think we've seen even with the existing ethanol program we have in place, every plant that's built is built a little differently than the one before. And the reason being is that new technologies become available, new information as these are being built. So I think what we're going to see, and it's probably part of the reason why we're not asking for the moon here in terms of price. It doesn't make sense to build a whole lot of plants right away because, like anything else, like any computer, as soon as it's built, it's almost outdated. And I think what we want to do is we want to start that first step, beginning the process, continuing the research. You know, one of the things that the university is doing right now is that they've applied for a grant from U.S. Department of Energy. I think it's for $125 million that would enable them to become one of two major research facilities in the U.S. as it relates to renewable energy. And so this sort of thing is not going to end here anytime soon. It's going to have to continue down the road, whether we get to the point where we're using hydrogen made from ethanol, whatever the case might be. This is going to be an evolving process along the way. So, you know, can I tell you that this is the end all? Absolutely not. But I do think it's a reasonable and worthwhile beginning to get where we need to be.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, thank you for those comments. My advice then, Mr. Chair, for what it's worth, is that, you know, we as a committee should be looking at not only this proposal, but then also the dollars that we're directing to the University of Minnesota for research in this area, and if there's opportunities to piggyback those dollars and get the best bang for the buck, so we're not reinventing the wheel in two different arms of government. That, I mean, I think we, again, will be the leader in this new emerging technology.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finstead and members, I'm not sure how many of you are aware, but just recently British Petroleum announced a $500 million grant to the University of California, Berkeley, I believe, and Chicago, or the University of Illinois, excuse me. Kind of a combination thing, and I heard some information about this this last weekend, but $500 million is a lot of money to go into renewable fuels. But, you know, it's coming from a major worldwide oil company, so there's probably just a little different perspective that they're looking at there, whereas I think Minnesota has tended to be looking at what are those kinds of ways we can be investing in a renewable fuel infrastructure that keeps most of that money in Minnesota.
That's good news, because I know that Berkeley Group and the Illinois Group were two of them that were competing for the dollars we're after in this state, so perhaps that will push them over to the other side a little bit and move us forward. There's still a lot of competition out there. But then secondly, Representative Finstead brings up a good reminder to the committee that anyone in this committee, anyone in this room who has suggestions for research needs at the University of Minnesota, again, this year we're going to attempt, in this body anyway, to write the ag special again like we have in the past and make sure that those needs are expressed over in Representative Rukavina's committee and hopefully carried on to conference and to the end of the day. So we are doing that, and we'll do that the last week in February, probably February 27th or 8th. So now is the time to get those ideas into our staff so we can start writing up language and understanding where we want to go. And I include the department in that. If you have suggestions for us, let us know, and we'll, in a general way, try and include these things in an ag special. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the point Representative Finstead brought up, and he brings up a wise point in my view, but in the next generation energy proposal that the governor submitted, and Representative Hilty, who's chair of the Energy Committee, is carrying it, there is significant dollars in there for research, and it's in several locations. And I keep talking about this, asking folks, let's step back, let's take a comprehensive, broad view of this thing and move a bill forward, a comprehensive bill, instead of this piecemeal stuff. Because if we keep going down the piecemeal route, then we lose track of things that we need as part of our machine to get us where we want to go, where we want to be in the end. If we wanted to be 25% by the year 25 of all energy used in the state, it's going to take several key pieces to get that machine put together to get us where we're at. And if we don't go down the comprehensive route, and I understand the Senate is not going to do that, they're going to trot people out every week to have a press conference on their little segment of the piece here and put it piece by piece together, then we run the risk of not having the machine together we need, or worse yet, Mr. Chairman, you've been here a long time and you know how things go. Worse yet, we get looking at May here, and all of a sudden we're trying to figure out how we can hold up the Senate, or the Senate can hold up us up, or both of us hold up the administration, and in the key parts of the comprehensive bill that we really want to have. And I sure don't want to see agriculture get the icky end of the stick come towards the end of Maine.
Thank you, Representative Magnus. And again, we continue our discussions with Hilty over there, too. And I think it is his intent to roll a lot of this into one larger bill, which I think I concur with, and Representative Peterson and others do, too. So we are trying to do that, but I think it, I don't know what the Senate's doing, and we're certainly going to move something over that'll get their attention. Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus. I share what he's saying, but I also disagree as to the process. Doesn't it make sense? I mean, I believe a lot of the package, what we're talking about is the governor's package, which Bill Hilty has. Now, don't you think it's appropriate through the process between the number of committees that certain parts of the package are going to have to travel through to move them separately and then with the option of rolling them in at the end, which has never been dismissed as a valid option, but you know, having that package go through how many committees, Representative Junkie, at least yours, at least, and Mary Ellen's, and Wagenius, and Hilty, you know, it's not just pull it apart and let one suffer. I think there's the option to roll it all in together with input from the commissioners and the governor's office, clearly. So just the deadlines and the policy deadlines make it such that we got to chunk it up a little.
And Representative Peterson, that's true. But what I mean is a package at the end, and certainly we have the ability to do that this year with our new finance committee structure, mm-hmm. because you can hear the bills around in different places. They end up in finance committee where we can assemble a bill based on different things. Because, again, you're right, the pump initiative from the governor to put 1,500 or 1,800 pumps is sitting in one committee. The XL money that's been alluded to that's out there currently that we're, again, going to look at directing to IREE or other places is sitting in another committee. Next generation monies are sitting here in this committee. I mean, already it's scattered, and I know in talks with the commissioner, I wish more of it would have been sitting in agriculture, because I think this is the right spot for a lot of this stuff to coalesce into one area, but that's not the case at this point. So we have some decisions to make on that, too, where we want to put it and where we want to house some of this money if it becomes a reality. We're not even to the point knowing where we're at on targets or anything else yet. So, but very good comments.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one comment to Representative Peterson alluded to it earlier, talking about the total energy package and sort of the 25% by 25 or whatever the year is, and certainly electricity is part of that as well. The legislature and the administration is very supportive of wind energy, and we know that plays an important part. One of the things I would request that this committee do is to keep an eye on the implications that has for agriculture, because part of the whole structure here is transportation, or part of the, and power lines become an essential part of moving that energy around the state, and farmers, of course, get to the position of hosting many of these power lines, oftentimes against their will. So as we look at this whole process, whether we're talking power lines or pipelines, whatever, it all has potential implications for agriculture. That not saying that we stop it. It's just that we've got to be cognizant of the impact that has and the issues that it creates. And before it's all over, we end up making some people unhappy. But it's part of what goes on in having to move an essential commodity, in this case electricity, from one area of the state to another.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, we just got through the next gen. We have not gotten through the ethanol producer payments, which will, and that will be typical. Members, we're going to try and put a number of things, give a heads up on budget items, but as we get into discussions, some will take longer, some will take less, and so we'll just keep forwarding them to the next committee hearing. So if there's no more questions for the Commissioner, are you done with us for now? We appreciate you being here. It was a good discussion today. Mr. Ernst, thanks for hanging out, and I know you'll have more to say on the producer payment end probably, and we'll look at starting with that tomorrow. With that, members, we are adjourned.